Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to episode 29 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly news and pop culture podcast brought to you by Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton.
Hi guys, how are you hanging? World's falling apart, but hopefully you're keeping it together, keeping it real, keeping it chill.
I wanted to do a really wild intro, but I always get nervous that this podcast episode will be the first podcast
that someone
listens to. And I don't want to lose them as they're cusping by doing something really lame by saying it's hosted by Dolly Alderton, which is how I originally thought I should intro the podcast.
I like that. Write into us. If you'd like us to mix it up a bit, we'll mix it up a bit.
I get tempted sometimes.
So do I.
It's lonely at the top.
I sometimes want to come in with a song. That's my natural.
Wow, I think you should try that.
Well, write
in. Given that intros aren't your strongest forte.
Well, that's what I thought I could express myself through.
It's better through song.
Exactly.
Okay, bring your guitar.
But, you know, people get very attached to certain formats.
I do read it the same every single week.
So maybe they like it. Let us know.
I'd also like to dedicate this episode of The Hi-Lo to my older sister, Enna, who, on the day that this comes out, will have just celebrated her last ever chemo session. She has battled through 6 months of chemo and is now feeling bloody exhausted. Her eyes are running, her nose is bleeding, her skin is dry. She has kept working full time the whole way through. Everyone who knows her is so proud of her. It's been amazing to watch her put up such a valiant fight, and we can't wait for you to start feeling better and getting back to your old self, because you really deserve it.
We love you, Enna. What have you been up to this week, Panda? Give us your ex.
So I did some speed mentoring on the London Eye at 7:30 this morning for...
So random.
International Day of the Girl, which is actually a really awesome UN initiative. And the speed mentoring bit of it involved lots and lots of schoolgirls and lots of different women going into a little pod and then sort of talking about their job and talking about what the girls are interested in. And I had some really, really interesting women in my pod, but I had some more interesting girls. My lot were all 14. I don't know if they all are, from year nine. And it was just really... It's interesting how nothing has changed in terms of, like, gender in the classroom, but then how much has changed and how aware the girls are of their position in the world.
Totally.
So this girl was like, I get a bit scared about saying I know the answer in the classroom because a boy will laugh at me. And I said, well, I think boys often laugh at girls, but you mustn't let that put you off, because you'll be the one laughing when you do something really cool when you're older. And
she was like... that will stay with her forever that you said that.
Well, she was like, oh yeah, like, I know that they're... She was like, I know that. It's just that there's 37 of us in our year out of 120. And it's more just how, you know, how as girls do we... She was talking about empowerment and stuff like that. And then another girl told me that she knew that girls were as good as boys, and that she, you know, was really into kind of supporting other girls. So even at 14, I think that they're just so much more aware of equality, which you should be. I mean, a lot's changed since we were...
Yeah, it's weird you should say that. The other... last week I went to my friend Will's house, and he's got three teenage daughters, and one of them is she made the news because she's campaigning for suffrage to be taught on the curriculum. And I kind of tried to help her with that, and then she emailed me this week being like, can you tell me the name of that woman at Camden Council that I think I should contact? And there is just a feeling that makes me so excited for your future daughter, for all our future kids, that they are just, for want of a better word, they are just more awake, more woke to this whole...
I think 14 is a really interesting age, actually, as well, because you're you're sort of a kid, sort of a teenager, and the gulf between the 14-year-olds. You'll have some 14-year-olds that will be reading newspapers, websites, you know, fully engaged with everything that's going on in the world. But then you'll have some 14-year-olds
that were still kids at that
point. Yeah, and children, won't be reading news outlets, won't be developing like political opinions. And I think, you know, that's always the way. I think it's quite an interesting age. Speaking of impressive teenagers, Malala, who has obviously just gone to Oxford University, posted this amazing tweet, which has had 1 million likes at the time of recording. 5 years ago, I was shot in an attempt to stop me from speaking out for girls' education. Today, I attend my first lectures at Oxford. And then there's just a picture of all her books with a pencil on top. It's an amazing tweet.
Yeah.
I've also been on an Instagram detox for the last 2 weeks, which was so nice, not because I was addicted to posting photographs, I found that really easy, but because the tendency to mindlessly scroll has become so incredibly ingrained. And I really caught myself going to do something on my phone, and then I was like, no, I'm just going to read for 15 minutes instead, or I'm just going to, no, actually it was pretty much I'm just going to read every single time, which is always good for me for replenishing the soul.
People did seem very shocked that you had a bit of an Instagram break.
I think it's really funny because the idea that we can be divorced from Instagram is something quite alien. And I don't, and I post more pictures than the average person, which I think probably leads people to think that I'm more addicted to Instagram than I am. Actually, most of my friends are on it more than I am. My husband, there is no way Ollie could do 2 weeks off Instagram. He freely admits it.
Yeah.
He could not have that time mindlessly scrolling. So I found it really funny how many people have been like, my God, how was it? And I'm like, I mean, it was what it was.
Yeah.
I didn't miss it at all. It felt really good. I want to, and actually I have spent so much less time on since I went back on.
Mm.
Still, I've posted a few pictures, but I'm only checking it. So what are we? We're recording this at 2 p.m. I've checked it once today.
The only thing that I missed, and you did mention it when I was in Hedra, is I miss seeing what my buddies are up to. That was the only thing I missed.
Did you see I did a mass liking? Could you tell when I came back on?
Yeah.
I did that. I looked up about 25 people, everyone that I could think of that I liked. And I don't mean like as in like, I've never met you before, your coffee table looks nice. I mean actual friends.
And yeah,
I
went your buddies, you want to see what they're doing.
And I liked everything from the last 2 weeks that I'd been off. I kind of missed that, but then I kind of would just say to friends,
send me a picture of
Hedra. It did obviously free up lots of time to do more reading, including Lullaby by Leila Slimani, which won the Goncourt, I believe it's pronounced, in France, which is the highest literary prize you can win in France. And it's just been translated. It comes out in January, and it's based on the story of a nanny from the Dominican Republic who murdered her young charges. And it's utterly chilling, but fantastically written, and I read it in a day.
I've got it on my bedside. I'm so excited to read it.
It's honestly, it's absolutely brilliant. I've had quite a few people being like, oh God, I couldn't read that. And it's obviously a very grisly premise. Lots of people have compared it to Louise Woodward, who is that nanny who was accused of shaking baby to death. I'm also halfway through Nothing to Envy by Barbara Demnick, which was the book recommended to us.
Yeah, our listeners told us to read that.
My sister gave it to me last week, and it was written in 2010 about North Korea. Dolly and I expressed on the podcast an interest to learn more about North Korea, having read this utterly mesmerising and bizarre piece in the Sunday Times about North Korea. And lots of people recommended us this book. And it really is shocking. It's a story of total and utter poverty. I mean, this is in the late 90s when Samsung was roaring through South Korea. And in North Korea, you have children dying from malnutrition. Mm. You have soup being made from salt and grass. You have surgeons and doctors in hospital deciding how many IV drips they can give you based on how many empty bottles you bring in for them. There was no light in the hospitals, so they would write their notes by the window, like trying to get the best amount of light. And this is in the late 90s. Mm. It's absolutely shocking. I'm only halfway through, but it's brilliant.
Is it a kind of full picture of all different lives in North Korea?
She speaks to six, she interviews at length over 5 years, six defectors when they're living in South Korea,
okay,
who had grown up there, who were completely entrenched in the system. I don't know at what point, because I'm only halfway through, I'm still completely in their lives that then and there. So I don't know how they came to leaving. But at this point, I mean, there's a couple in it. The girl's called Mirin, and she goes out with her boyfriend for 9 years, and it took them 3 years to hold hands and like 9 years to kiss. No one knew anything about sex. So it wasn't, you know, is abortion a thing in North Korea? You wouldn't even have sex.
No one
was like, you have no idea the level of censorship. They just didn't even know. All the textbooks were about the evil Japanese and the evil Americans. They had no...
It's so hard to get your head round.
They didn't know there was anything beyond that.
It's so hard to get your head round that in a world where, like, you know, I was browsing for, like, vases this morning, North Korea exists. Do you know what I mean?
I know
that sounds really trite, but, like, sometimes I'll go and read these, like, bulleted facts about North Korea, and I'm like, how can this be existing in the same world that I exist in?
One of the most interesting things
for
me...
And we don't know anything about it, really, because it's so secretive.
I know. One of the most interesting things, actually, for me, was that it reminded me of Hunger Games, when they determine where you live based on your kind of seniority and, like, devotion to the system.
Yeah.
So there's only one... town, if I haven't got that quite right, called Pyongyangnang. Again, sorry if I've pronounced that wrong. I don't have the book on me to double check. But that's the place where foreigners, if they're allowed into North Korea, are allowed. And that is people at the top of the class system who all work kind of in the government or a senior in the army.
So it's a front, basically.
Yeah. So there's a toy town. You never get to that town if you... There's only 250 miles between... that town and where Mirin lives in the countryside, but it takes 3 days to get there.
Oh yeah, because all those highways are deserted. Children use them as playgrounds.
It's just absolutely
I can't wait to read that.
I was really excited to receive through the post a copy of Tom Hanks's debut work of fiction.
Who did you have to snog to get that?
I got it. No one. I didn't even know it was coming.
Who publishes it?
Penguin.
Oh, for God's sake.
It comes out next week, I think, on the 17th of October. And it's a book of short stories called Uncommon Type. I'll lend it to you afterwards, doll.
Thanks.
I read a few of them in bed last night, and I bloody loved the story, An Exhausting 3 Weeks. They're really genuinely good short stories, not some Hollywood vanity project.
No, he's a fab writer. I just love him as a person so much.
You'll love him even more after look at that sexy photo.
I love him. Sometimes I think about the day that Tom Hanks is going to die and I just can't think about it. I don't know what I'm going to do.
His wife's very cool as well.
She's so cool.
Rita something.
Yeah.
I was excited to read a series of interviews with Esther Perel in Red and The Telegraph and The Sunday Times about her new book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, which really chimed with our recent author special with the comedian Rosie Wilby about her book Is Monogamy Dead? Look at us, finger on the zeitgeist of these conversations. So for those of you that don't know, Esther Perel is an iconic psychotherapist who became famous for coining the term erotic intelligence about a decade ago. She's pretty persuasive, but I also really enjoy the case studies in her new book, which are just written in such a uniquely American way. Here's a sentence from it. Jonah and Danielle's sex life had faded out when Danielle discovered Jonah's weekly massages had been of the happy ending variety and that his hours spent on the computer were not spent watching World of Warcraft. What's a woman to do when she discovers her vanilla husband has an unexplored spice cabinet? I really wanted to read that out in American accent, but I practiced this morning and my American accent, having been marvellous for decades, has suddenly
gone.
Yeah, so I didn't want to risk ruining the spice cabinet.
She's wonderful, Esther Perel. I think she's really changing, me myself included, how a lot of people look at relationships and love.
Do you think you'll read that book? I wasn't sure if I was quite ready for another book on monogamy.
Yeah, no, I definitely will. I've read Mating in Captivity, which I loved.
Is that the book that made her famous?
Yeah, and her TED Talk is particularly brilliant.
I want to watch that, and I'm so behind on my TED Talks because I want to watch the one you said about Brené Brown as well.
Oh, yeah.
And try and figure out Audible for the power of vulnerability. I'll get there.
Give me your phone when we leave today. I'll sort it out for you.
God, that's the first and last time you'll ever
be
able to sort something out on my phone.
Me, this like tech support.
Speaking of talks and podcasts, I dipped my toe into the water of the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast with Tanzila Ahmed and Zara Norbakhsh after I heard them on Call Your Girlfriend podcast. And I want to go back and listen to loads more of them. It's a monthly podcast that comes out. They're both American. They have this great segment called Awkward Ask a Muslim, where they regale uncomfortable things that they have been asked as a Muslim woman. For example, and it's actually, I think, if everyone listened to it, they'd be vastly educated about how to... how to communicate with not just Muslim women, but with Islam as a whole at the moment. We have such a problematic cultural relationship, don't we?
With, definitely.
The one I found really interesting was an example they gave of why they don't swim. And they both said, you know, one of them, either Taz or Zara, and I'm so sorry, I haven't listened to enough to figure out whose voice is which voice, which is not an insult, as people say it took 48 episodes to work out who was Pandora and who was Dolly.
I think people are still rewinding confused. And trying to work it out.
So either Taz or Zara said, you know, don't ask me why I don't swim, because part of the reason why I don't swim is it just wasn't appropriate in my household for me to swim after fifth grade. There were never the right outfits. And she said, you know, if I was a teen and the burkini was around, then I'd have swum more. Mm. And so because she never swum very much as a kid, she doesn't feel confident in the water now. And she actually still, she said, going onto modest websites, she's still not really happy with the kind of selection of swimwear out there. To not ask a Muslim woman why she can't swim. I was like, I hadn't considered that.
Yeah.
I hadn't considered that. And they had other really interesting stuff on there, like, this white woman said, I really want to understand the Muslim female experience. So, like, would it be insulting for me to wear a hijab for a day? And one of the girls was like, well, if you want to understand the Muslim female experience, there are many other ways to do it than putting on a hijab and taking it off. And she's like, yeah, but is it insulting? And the girl, so sorry again, can't remember which one of the girls was like, are you asking me to speak on behalf of all Muslim women?
Yeah.
She goes, yeah, I'm asking you to speak on behalf of Muslim women. She was like, but I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of all white women. Like, yeah. I can't tell you it's okay to wear a hijab. And ultimately, the other girl was like, it's not okay. It's never okay. Go learn about the Muslim female experience from another place. Yeah. Anyway, it's a really interesting
it's
podcast.
It's so good. Obviously, it's good for anything that kind of busts that tense feeling of Islamophobia that you can often feel in the air at the moment. But it's also good because I think so many, for better or worse, you know, it's a very complicated issue, but so many white liberal women take it upon themselves to speak on behalf of Muslim women. So I think it's really interesting and really crucial to have their voice heard of what the Muslim female experience is, because only they know. We don't know. We can't tell them what they can be offended by or not.
You don't have to agree or understand with the way different religions choose to exist. So if you're listening and you're like, I'm sorry, I think I'm liberal, but I just can't get on board with the hijab. I don't understand the veil. I'm not a fan of the burkini. I understand that it's actually quite a problematic thing for a lot of women, that shrouding of the body. But what I found great listening to that podcast is they're not asking you to agree with it.
No, they're asking you to understand the context.
They're asking you to learn and to listen.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing to remember, because I sometimes struggle to be like, oh my God, but I don't agree with that. You know, I find that problematic. And it's okay to find it problematic, but just, you know, watch your kind of discourse in how you relay that.
And as you said, just listen. You know, that's the most important thing we can
do. Anyway,
it's
a very good podcast. I'll try and remember to put it in the show notes and tweet it. What about you, Dolly? What are your recs from the week?
Not that many this week. I watched 5 Foot 2, which is the Lady Gaga documentary on Netflix.
Ah, Charlie's nodding. Have you watched that?
Oh, no. I thought we had a secret Gaga fan in the studio. I love Lady Gaga. Love her. I've really, really loved her in my early 20s.
Interesting. Were you a fan of the meat dress? Do you have your
own
meaty dress?
Yeah, I was. No, I didn't have a meaty dress. I thought she was an artist, and I loved how she... I loved her Warholian exploration of fame, culture, and kind of iconism, if that is a word.
Iconicism?
Iconicism. Don't know.
Still out for jury's out.
And then she kind of lost me. I got kind of bored of it. And she lost me when she started... When was it that she had her male counterpart? That's when the art became to a point where she was dressing up as a man and...
Oh, yes. I can't remember.
I got to a point there where I was like, oh, you've lost me a bit now, I think.
But she brought you back with this documentary.
Yeah, she really did. And what's so interesting about her is that she's cultivated this persona over the years. Because, you know, she was a kid when she got famous. She was 21. And she cultivated this persona of distance, of old school stardom. That was her whole thing that I found really fascinating, where it's like, I'm a slave to my fans. I am a public persona. It's my job to constantly refresh myself, keep them entertained, keep them interested and enchanted and beguiled and curious. I will fail as an artist if I give them anything weak.
Like or, Madonna.
Yeah, I will fail if I give them anything too human of me, because that's not what they look for to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny that she became this sort of bastion of authenticity, you know, be yourself, be who you are, whatever. And then what you see in this documentary, first of all, I think she's a mess through most of it. She's constantly crying. She seems like she's just a woman who is on the verge of tears. She looks very vulnerable throughout the whole thing. And she passes that off as being, you know, kind of suffering for her art and the kind of martyrdom of being an artist. But I think it's just that she's a heartbroken girl, and literally it starts with as she breaks up with her fiancé.
I was going to say, didn't she break up with her fiancé?
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. And she's also in immense physical pain. She has a recurring injury that they follow as one of the narratives from when she broke her hip dancing. But what's so interesting is that this is really Gaga saying, I want to strip away everything that I've been throwing at you for the last 10 years.
I think that's a similar trajectory to Miley Cyrus as well.
She's doing it, I don't want to do the meat dress, I don't want to do the distance, I don't want to do the strange voice, the odd cadence that she had. Mm. All of it's gone. And what she has done instead is she's stripped herself back. She keeps saying, I want to just be a woman, I want to grow up and be a woman. She wants to wear black jeans and boots and a t-shirt, and she wants to be herself. And what's so heartbreaking as you watch it is that she exposes herself for the first time as this woman. You really see the human underneath all that stuff, and people aren't interested in it. It's really interesting to watch.
Well, we've talked before about people not letting kind of celebrities evolve in the same way that like a typical young woman, like,
yeah, exactly,
you know, mine and your style has changed.
How we express ourselves
has changed. Our interests have changed.
Our politics.
I was thinking, actually, I was driving yesterday and I was in the car and I was thinking, my God, my 20s have been such a time for learning. I have learned so much.
Mm.
And I've been allowed to do that because I'm not in the public eye.
Yeah.
But she and Miley Cyrus and anyone else like this, they're just not allowed to evolve.
No. And I think people get so attached of a commodity that they believe
is
theirs, particularly when it's with her monsters, you know, and there's such a weird cultish thing. Like, there's this horrible moment where she's going through crowds and they cut back. It's beautifully edited. The soundtrack on it is incredible. And they cut back to her going through crowds in the past, and they show her with this mad outfit that pops up like a sort of picture pop-up book. They show her kind of in a mask. They show her in all these different guises. And then they just show her now kind of just stomping through in her jeans and her boots. And it's, I think they're making a point of how she wants to get to this point of feeling herself and feeling authentic. And what's so funny is that you look back on that first 10 years now of her career, and what I think she was saying was, I was trying to keep you all at arm's length because I wasn't happy with who I am. Now I am. Accept me for this.
Yeah.
So it's, I found it a really compelling and beautiful watch. I watched it twice, actually.
Did you?
I did, yeah. There was a lot to kind of pick up on. So anyway, I would thoroughly recommend that. Only if you're a Gaga fan, though, I think, because other people I saw on Twitter were saying it's a bit self-indulgent, but I loved it.
Documentaries are inherently, that's like,
yeah, exactly.
That's like reading an autobiography and being like, I mean, it was a, you know, it was a bit one note. Like,
yeah, and I mean, there's some weird stuff, like at the end you see producer Lady Gaga, but, you know, think about Kris Jenner. That's just how the beast works. And then the other thing that I really loved this week was an old episode of WTF with Marc Maron, with Russell Brand. And that's, again, a quite an interesting point in his career, in his life, because I think that's during the breakdown of his marriage with Katy Perry. And the reason I loved it so much is that, first of all, Marc Maron, the host, has been sober for 20 years. Russell Brand famously has been sober and off drugs for 10 years, I think. So there's a very interesting dialogue between two people talking about those shared and different experiences. It's very rich anecdotally. It really gives you an insight into the great, like, glamour and excitement and fun of those times, as well as the grim, dark, deathly period. And they talk about it with real honesty that I just really respect. But the bit I really loved is, I've never really heard Russell Brand talking about how he was a fat kid before.
It's in my bookie work.
Oh, is it good? I now want to read that book.
It's really good.
So there's this bit in it, I was a fat kid, and there's this bit there, he's talking about how when you were big as a teenager and no one fancied you and you always felt kind of divorced from your body because you can't grow into your sexual adolescent self when you feel like you're covered in puppy fat, like it feels like you're not allowed to try that out in a way that everyone else is. And he said that he blames a lot of how he behaves even now on the fact that when you were once a fat child, you just carry that fat kid with you constantly, and that fat kid is always saying to you, capitalize on this experience, you never know when it's going to go, look where you are now, if that woman wants to fuck you, go fuck that woman, you owe me as a fat kid who never had any fun to do all this stuff. And I've never heard someone articulate it so well, and he does it in a very funny way that's very raw as well about how he always will carry that voice with him. And I think a lot of people, whether you are fat or thin, feel that kind of debt to their younger self.
Yeah.
That they have to have this experiential, you know, wild time in their adult life.
He's actually got a book. He's back in the newspapers at the moment because he's got a new book out about addiction, about recovering.
Oh, okay.
I think it must be out now because I actually read several interviews with him this weekend.
I love him. I know a lot of people don't. I think I really like him.
I love him in writing. When I see him on the telly, he can sometimes drive me a bit mad. It's that sort of, I know I have quite flowery language, but
yeah.
He was on Lorraine, and you know, the sort of esotericness of his rambling vernacular just didn't really work with like Dan Wooden, the celebrity. He looked so uncomfortable next to him.
It's so true. It reminds me of when he got political and he wanted to start this like revolution.
We went out with Jemima Khan
for a bit. I remember there was a period where every time I watched something, an interview with him, it was like, you know, Joey on Friends where he does the thesaurus letter. Yes. Baby kangaroo. Tribbiani. That's what it felt like.
We had some great listener responses to last week's segment on Playboy and the death of Heath. And I just wanted to read out one email that we got, as I think it really emphasises how we have come to view Playboy as a modern society, and that for some women, those working there, the Playboy empire was actually a positive rather than a negative thing. I'll keep this listener anonymous just in case she'd rather people didn't know that it was her. I was listening to your episode on Playboy and I couldn't help but email in to offer an insight into life as a modern day bunny. She doesn't say when she worked there, FYI, but it wasn't in the sort of 60s, 70s Gloria Steinem time. For me, Playboy enabled me to earn money while I was figuring out life and making friends, learning a new skill and getting some life experience. The club and rules have changed since it was opened in the 60s. Bunnies cannot fraternise with punters, whereas back in the day you could catch a rich man. Now you'd be fired for it. Common misconception is that men can touch you and they can't. Most punters are there for the casino, and on the whole, I probably came across more sleaze in the street than I did at work. There are other casinos when you could earn just as much money. It's just not as fun. Playboy gave my early 20s so much excitement. The girls I met are hilarious and intelligent. It can be a job that you do for a couple of years to earn some good money. Heath did good and bad for women. Like you said, it differs tremendously. Being a bunny in the London club is being very different to being one of his girlfriends. I was a bunny dealer, so for me the only issue was angry customers when they were losing. Punters can call you a whore, scream, shout, but that's a problem in all casinos. How Playboy is seen in society is interesting. I experienced a lot of judgment from other women in the club and outside. For example, one October, myself and another bunny were asked to stand at Waterloo Station and raise money for breast cancer awareness in our pink bunny outfits. Women approached us and told us we were disgusting and we should be ashamed of ourselves. People can disagree and people can judge, as of course they always will, but it did give a lot of women a lot of happiness. I will always look back fondly on my 2 years there, and I know I'm not the only one.
Thank you so much for writing that. We also had a couple of vociferous, shall we say, responses from some PRs about our discussion on the role of the publicist last week in regards to Claire Balding. To recap, a journalist called Ginny Duggery claimed that she had her byline removed from an interview she did with the broadcaster for Saga magazine after Claire's publicist insisted on inserting quotes from Claire that had not been part of Ginny's interview. Here are a few excerpts from a few emails we received. We'll keep this lady anonymous as she might not want her name attached to her outrage. Do you really believe that the PR who had to sit in the room next door with the door ajar whilst you interviewed a celebrity didn't feel like a burk? Perhaps you could have asked them into the room you actually did the interview in. Did you not honestly understand the pressure that person may have been under to not make her client appear to be a dick? The anecdote about the PR denying something that her client had said and then being grateful to have been proved wrong as a result of the interview being recorded really struck a chord for me. I'm not surprised she was grateful. I have endlessly been told by clients, I've been misquoted, I never said that, get it changed. And to be able to go back to the client and say, actually, you did say it, it's on tape, would be a massive relief. We also had an email from Harriet. I couldn't agree more with your comments regarding the infuriation of being asked for copy approval, or even worse, having your copy edited, which must be incredibly insulting. Interviews are an art form, and that the soul of an interview is stripped away the minute a PR sits in the room is as awful for us as it is for you. Unfortunately, we work with clients that sometimes demand such a thing, even when advised otherwise. Ultimately, what the client wants, the client gets, or we lose their business to someone else. As a listener who values your opinion and thoughts on all topics, I ask for a little more balance at times to PR people when we come up for discussion. I know we can be bloody annoying at times, but we do work incredibly hard and try our best to work within the parameters set upon us by clients.
Those are fair emails, although the first one did make us laugh as it was actually much, much longer in original form. And it sort of escalated with fury until said anonymous PR signed off with, well, you've both got colossal egos. I think Dolly and her have reached a rapprochement of sorts. And to be honest, we totally understand that it's insulting to be written off as a buzzy fly ruining an art form. To be honest, that's actually not how we intended it. And I don't totally think if you're not a PR, I don't think you necessarily would have read it like that. Because what we meant to say is that PR is a valid and valuable industry upon which the media cannot run. I actually think it's more the way we treat celebrities now. They shouldn't be so cosseted. The onus should not be on the PR to protect the celebrity from themselves, and the publicist should not offer themselves up in that sort of facilitatory, way. So it's a chicken and an egg situation, but we certainly weren't meaning to insinuate that all PRs are twats, because we don't think that.
No, and also Pandora and I are well aware that a vast majority, perhaps, of our listenership will probably be women who work in those industries, so we don't feel that at all. But Pandora watched from the sidelines as I forwarded her all the exchanges between me on the high-low Gmail account and this PR that we mentioned, and it became a sort of Thomas Crown Affair chess scene game of intellect, with one email actually beginning with the sentence "touché." But anyway, we reached a truce, as Pandora said, and we do always welcome hearing the other side of every story. So thank you as ever to everyone who writes in to thehilowshow@gmail.com. That's what the Hilo's founding ethos of widespread curiosity is all about. And speaking of curiosity,
on to some super exciting news. Did you like die when you heard about this, Dolly?
I like totally died.
You know, that's the dialogue in most American podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to fault the podcasting as others, as we are far from infallible ourselves, but there are so many likes. I sound like a 70-year-old pedant Hagrid, but I'm constantly shocked by how many likes and the thing is and totally there are when I listen to podcasts. Anyway, the exciting news. We are thrilled to announce that we have a shiny new sponsor, possibly the shiniest sponsor we could have ever dreamed of. From November through till June of next year, the Hilo will be partnering with Google, and specifically the Google Pixel 2 phone. We'll be able to tell you more come November, but ahead of this pant-wettingly exciting partnership, ooh, we're doing a live podcast for Google at Selfridges as part of the Curiosity Room experience. If you didn't get a ticket to our live podcast on the 16th of October, which sold out in 15 minutes, woohoo, then hopefully you can snaffle one for our Google talk at Selfridges next Friday. The Curiosity Room is an immersive experience where you can try out the Google Pixel 2 phone and a Google Home Mini. I have a Google Home at home, and let me tell you, getting it to do animal noises is the most uplifting interlude you could imagine inserting in your day. At the Curiosity Rooms, you can listen to inspiring talks by the likes of the actor who you will recognise from The Night Of and Girls, Riz Ahmed, model and girls talk activist Adwa Abua, and E.S. Devlin, the set designer for Adele, Beyonce and Kanye West. And of course, the humble Hilo.
I think we fit right in there. We're quite similar, Riz Ahmed. If you'd like to come along to our talk on Friday, October the 20th at 6:30 p.m, please visit events.withgoogle.com/curiosity rooms. The link will be in the show notes, plus on the Hilo's Twitter and our own Twitter, and in our Instagram bios too. The talk is 45 minutes. Tickets are free. Yes, free. And if you're lucky, you can ask a question. Thank you so much to Google and the Google Pixel 2. We couldn't be more excited to have a legitimate reason to hang out in Google HQ, which really is as cool as you think it is.
It also has free mini dime bars. It's really important, despite these big, exciting developments as the high-low hits puberty, to stay humble. I don't know about you, Dolly, but I stay humble by texting my dad about the high-low's news. My dad's reply was, "What's the high-low?" So, you know, there's that. Support for the high-low comes from revolutionary tights brand Heist. Heist launched with the aim of turning tights from a, let's say, necessary evil into something that women should be excited to wear. Their tights, a 3D knitted design that borrows from Italian sportswear, are, quite literally, the most comfortable tights I've ever worn. In fact, should you be interested, I named them unequivocal winner of my luxury tights test when I was at the Sunday Times Style.
I'd like to flag up, and yes, I'm going to go there, that the seamless gusset...
God, I love the word gusset.
I love the word gusset. The seamless gusset makes such a difference to how comfy these tights are.
Heist have a theory that tights should be delicious to wear without costing $1 million. They're also the softest tights around, with 5,000 spirals of nylon wound around each inch of elastane. Most tights have 500 spirals for reference.
I like the idea that tights have spiral counts like sheets have thread counts.
Think of these as the frette of tights. Bed linen connoisseurs will get that.
Heist tights start at £19 and are available at www.heist-studios.com. The link will be in our show notes. And listeners of the High Low can get 20% off their first order using the code HIGHLOWHEIST.
Heist have recently partnered with London charity Smartworks, donating tights to help women who are getting back into the workplace.
Thank you very much to Heist.
It's now time for the top line, read by Dollyaldertron.
Hit us with some tunes, Charlie. I'm looking for love, a dear love, and I'm searching high and low. Disclosing your gender may be made voluntary in the 2021 census after claims that it could discriminate against transgender people. The recommendation has been made in an Office for National Statistics report on gender identity. The proposed change could leave Britain without an accurate figure for the number of men and women living in the country. Donald Trump is being sued by the state of California and a civil rights group over healthcare coverage changes for workers, which could remove free contraception for women. Currently, the Affordable Care Act rules that employers have to pay for women on their payroll who are on the pill. But Trump's government have altered the legislation to allow bosses to back out of their obligations on the grounds of religious or moral beliefs. Assault Action Group has warned that giving your children a bowl of pesto pasta could be less healthy than giving them a Happy Meal. The amount of salt in pesto is rising, with the average serving now containing 1.5 grams of salt, research found, overtaking McDonald's hamburgers, which contain 1.2. Leaked emails from former International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, claim that Angelina Jolie offered to act as a honey trap in a secret plan to help snare notorious African warlord Joseph Kony. Angelina Jolie has the idea to invite Kony to dinner and arrest him, wrote the Argentinian lawyer. Jolie once wrote to him, "Brad is being supportive. Let's discuss logistics. Much love. Three kisses." "She loves to arrest Kony," the lawyer wrote. "She is ready. Probably Brad will go also." It's an exciting week for Pandora's overloved and slightly overhumanized cat Indy, as IKEA announces they are set to launch a range of pet furniture. The range features beds, mats and bowls for dogs, and scratching posts, blankets and litter scoops for cats. The range, called Lövig, which translates to shaggy or hairy in Swedish, was developed by IKEA designers and trained veterinarians and is priced from just 60p.
60p.
It's also an exciting week for basic millennial women, hey, who don't know their limits with alcohol, as Lidl are bringing out an organic Prosecco that they claim won't give you a hangover. The headache-free tipple is hitting stores today and can be yours for just $7.99 a bottle. The secret of the organic Prosecco Spumante is that it contains fewer sulfates than non-organic fizz.
Yeah, right, buy that one.
But it's a terrible week for future gap yearers the world over, as Thailand announces an imminent law which bans smoking on beaches across the country. Violation of this law could see you facing up to a year in prison. The ban, which aims to decrease litter and will begin next month, will apply to up to 20 beaches in areas including the popular tourist destinations of Phuket and Koh Samui, where, incidentally, I'm going on holiday in a few weeks.
As a smoker.
A Dove Facebook advert showing a black woman turning into a white one has been taken down after backlash on social media. When complaints were initially made, Dove responded by saying, "The content featured demonstrates the benefits of our Dove body wash for every type of skin," before later stating, "An image we recently posted on Facebook missed the mark in representing women of colour thoughtfully. We deeply regret the offence it caused." A British-Iranian charity worker and mother being held in Iran faces two more charges in relation to her alleged involvement in trying to overthrow the government. 38-year-old Nazenin Zaghari Ratcliffe has served 19 months of a five-year term for alleged security offences. She denies the charges of attempt to topple the regime in Tehran, which carry an extra 16 years in prison if proven. The CEO at the Thomson Reuters Foundation said the accusations she was trying to overthrow the regime is a complete invention, and added that the charity worker was subject to inhumane treatment, which had already caused irreparable damage. Here comes a piece of news that I can guarantee will make you instantly cross your legs tightly and make your buffer feel a bit nervous. The speculum, every woman's most dreaded piece of apparatus in her GP's office, has received a much-needed redesign. The metal pelvic... Oh, I hate saying this. The metal pelvic exam tool has remained essentially unchanged since it was invented 150 years ago by a man. Female employees at the San Francisco-based design firm Frog have angled the new design at 105 degrees, making it more comfortable, coated it in surgical silicone, and designed three leaves to expand the vagina, rather than a push handle with just one setting. It is part of a project to humanise the cervical smear experience. And that was the top line. Many apologies for that last one, Charlie. I'm looking for love, a dear love, and I'm searching high
and low. Oh. It is about time, isn't it? Because so many women dread having a smear test. It's so uncomfortable and it makes you feel quite emotional.
I think that's it. Actually was off the back of research that showed that that was the
number one reason. I bet there are women that were putting
reason.
Off going, yeah. Which means that they were not being necessarily detected for cervical cancer.
Yeah.
You know how many women will be affected by Trump's pill changes? 55 million. 55 million women.
Bad news about Thailand, isn't it? The thing is, it's annoying, is that I don't really smoke anymore. I only smoke on holiday on the beach with a cocktail.
Well, I am not sad that you can no longer do that.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There was a lot of news in the world of sexism this week. A Swedish artist and model named Arvida Bystrom has been threatened with rape after revealing her hairy legs in an Adidas advert. An editor for Vice's women's channel, broadly, named Mitch Sunderland, is revealed via leaked emails to have encouraged alt-right media personality Milo Yiannopoulos to troll feminists such as Lindy West. And of course, there's Harvey Weinstein. Harvey bloody Weinstein, from which a scandal has blossomed so large and engulfing that it is not unlike a stultifying fart that leaves everyone in the room speechless and gasping and traumatised by the overpowering stench of it all.
That's a very good metaphor.
In light of this, we've decided to dedicate today's discussion solely to this one topic. It is a story of systemic sexism that Hollywood has been built upon. It is the ultimate downfall of a man who has run the movie industry for as long as Dolly or I can remember.
So to fill you in, if you've been in a news vacuum these last few days...
To which I say, how jolly, and I hope you send us a postcard.
Well, precisely. 65-year-old American film producer Harvey Weinstein, who co-founded Miramax Pictures and is behind films including Pulp Fiction, Shakespeare in Love, Billy Elliot the Musical, has been sensationally fired from his own company, The Weinstein Company, which he founded and ran with his brother Bob after an expose in the New York Times on October the 5th titled... Harvey Weinstein paid off sexual harassment accusers for decades, revealed that he had sexually harassed vast swathes of Hollywood's female population, including the actress Ashley Judd. In the aftermath of this article, masses of other actors came forward to say that Harvey had harassed them as well. In a statement to the New York Times, Harvey said that he is taking a leave of absence. I appreciate the way I've behaved with colleagues in the past has caused a lot of pain, and I sincerely apologise for it. Though I'm trying to do better, I know I have a long way to go. Naturally, his apology only goes so far, if anywhere, frankly. He's also planning to sue the New York Times for defamation.
Oh, pull the other one. Sorry in advance, Mum, because I know you hate it when I swear, but you don't give a fucking shit about the pain you've caused, HW. You'd have merrily planned on sticking it everywhere it wasn't wanted for as long as you possibly could. You're not sorry for what you've done. You're sorry you got caught. Mm. It's a truly shocking roster of names that have emerged. These are not C-listers or bit part actors. They are Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, Roseanne Arquette. Gwyneth actually revealed that Brad Pitt, her boyfriend at the time, confronted Harvey, and soon after, the producer then warned her not to tell anyone else about his come on. I thought he was going to fire me, she said. And then there are dozens of other stories with people that aren't necessarily actors. For example, the tale of the pot plant. Poor pot plant. A former Fox News reporter, Lauren Sivan, said she was cornered in a restaurant in Manhattan 10 years ago by Harvey, who got his dick out and ejaculated into a pot plant. And then there is a young assistant in New York in 1990, an Italian model in 1995. I mean, the list goes on. The fallout has been huge. His wife, the British fashion designer Georgina Chapman, with whom he has two young children, has left him. He's been fired from the Weinstein Company, which he co-founded, and he's gone, quelle surprise, to a sex addiction clinic, like every busted old pervert trying to publicly reform.
I love the tone you're taking with this topic, Pandora. What's so staggering are the direct quotes from celebrities who have literally piled forward in this takedown, as they rightfully should, and I'm so grateful they have. Meryl Streep described the news as disgraceful, inexcusable, and an abuse of power. She called the women who've spoken out against him heroes. Romola Garai described an encounter with him in a hotel room where a lot of these incidents seem to take place that left her feeling violated. Gwyneth Paltrow describes a similar incident of which she said, I was a kid, I was signed up, I was petrified. Obama, whose daughter was an intern at Weinstein's company, said, Michelle and I have been disgusted by the recent reports about Harvey Weinstein. Any man who demeans and degrades women in such a fashion needs to be condemned and held accountable regardless of wealth or status. We should celebrate the courage of women who have come forward to tell these painful stories. And we all need to build a culture by empowering our girls and teaching our boys decency and respect so we can make such behaviour less prevalent in the future.
Oh, Barack, Barack, the heart beats. Equally staggering are the allegations that actors such as Matt Damon and Ben Affleck helped kill stories about Harvey, i.e. silenced female actors for their own and Harvey's gain, which is pretty fucking terrible. On to the scandal itself, I'm not surprised, not one bit. Why? Because I'd heard it for years that this was happening. Rumours, I'm very careful to call them rumours, had reached my ears as a journalist via other reporters or friends that worked in the movie industry. I have heard of young A-list actors who he had sex with. To clarify, I'm unsure if it was rape or if it was a sexual relationship, but either way, it was always expressed to me as one of imbalance. And then said young actors saw their careers elevated to the highest echelon. I cannot name any names for obvious reasons. It would be litigious and ultimately I don't know which are true, but they are familiar names. They are names you and I will recognise as top billings in movies. I have heard of actors who were blacklisted for not wearing Marchesa, his wife's label, on the red carpet. And it's all staggeringly reminiscent of Alfred Hitchcock, who stalked and harassed the actor Tippi Hedren before killing her career by keeping her locked in what they called golden handcuffs, where he had her on a contract, which meant no one else could make movies with her, but refused to put her in any of his own. I love Meryl Streep. I mean, it's Meryl, who doesn't? But I don't believe she didn't know, which is what she has said. She said she heard the rumours, but she hoped they were just rumours. Mm. I just can't believe she didn't know, because it sounds like everyone knew. The actor Rebecca Hall, who is married to the director Sam Mendes, was apparently protected by her publicists from him. Someone actually tweeted us saying, are you going to talk about the fact that Kate Winslet, Sam Mendes's ex-wife, stood by Woody Allen but condemned Harvey Weinstein? And I thought that's a really interesting point. If Woody Allen blows up like Harvey does, rather than continues to simmer beneath the surface like it does at the moment, would Kate still stand by him? There's an obvious strength in power, and I do get that, but it makes you wonder. Speaking of Woody Allen, I find it really interesting that his son, Ronan Farrow, a reporter who absolutely loathes his father, Woody, and is very outspoken about condemning his actions as a supposed perpetrator of sexual crimes, wrote one of the key articles out there on the scandal for The New Yorker. In a 10-month investigation, 13 women told me that Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed or assaulted them. Three alleged rape, he wrote on a now wildly retweeted post on Twitter.
That whole New Yorker piece by Ronan Farrow is brilliant. It also goes into the full spectrum of his alleged abusive actions against women, which range from calling meetings in hotel rooms while he wore a bathrobe to physically forcing himself on women. This story, I think, it's a bit like when this Jimmy Savile story broke, in that it's shrouded in this very strange atmosphere of inevitability, which feels like a sort of big sigh of relief from Hollywood. Every article you read, there are traces that this is something that everyone knew about for a really long time. In Romola Garai's account, there's this horrible bit where she says that before she was sent up to the hotel suite, you know, she was 18, the execs on the movie said in so many words, "This is sort of horrible, but sadly it's what you have to do." And I think a lot of that sort of attitude can be neatly summarised by this quote, which personally I found the most maddening thing to come out of the whole scandal. Weinstein said he came of an age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behaviour and workplaces were different. That was the culture then. And then, astonishingly, a lawyer subsequently said, "Mr. Weinstein denies many of the accusations as patently false and said he was an old dinosaur learning new ways." And it's exactly this sort of shit that was said in the wake of the Savile case, when people kept saying it was just the 70s. I'm sorry, the 70s weren't ancient Greece. Rape was not a part of the accepted workplace in the 60s and 70s. Rape is not like a typewriter. It's such a bullshit, lazy excuse, it really annoys me to blame an era in this sort of nostalgic, jokey way. Harvey Weinstein is not some friendly old Barney the dinosaur. Like, he's not an old man stuck in his ways who still has his milk delivered by a milkman or a granny who's a bit politically incorrect. He's plain and simple, a straight up abuser.
Yeah, you're so right. It's like Bill Cosby. It's this audible sigh of relief from a whole cluster of people because no one has to keep this huge secret anymore. His wife, Georgina, has now left him, but I don't believe she didn't know. If I knew, surely she knew. His company has fired him. But again, I don't think because they didn't know. I think it's because the public didn't know. They didn't have to fire him. And that's the crucial thing here. It's brilliant that all this has come to light. It's bloody brilliant. It's about time that that casting couch trope of a young girl having to bang an old dude to get a role was properly shattered. Interestingly, in 2010, a writer named Courtney Enlow coined a phrase for the actresses who seemed to pop up out of nowhere. "The Harvey girls are easily spotted," she wrote in a piece that referred to the widespread rumours of Weinstein's casting couch ways, reported the Times newspaper. "Their instant fame and the push behind them come seemingly out of nowhere and without any justifications in terms of resume or skill set." I have to wonder if his wife would have left him, or if his company would have fired him, or if any of these actors would have publicly condemned him had the New York Times not finally published a story they had been apparently trying to publish for 10 years.
Really? I didn't know
that. And there's this amazing picture in black and white which got tweeted from someone at the New York Times of all those reporters hunched over a computer about to press send on the article, knowing it would shatter Hollywood. I'd actually heard of numerous publications trying to publish this story in the past, with Harvey's camp always quashing it with something juicy, which is not, as I have to be honest, unusual in the media. I've heard of celebrities quashing stories by offering up juicy bits about someone else, and it is a facet of publishing, but he seemed to really revel in it. Tina Brown, a Vanity Fair, New Yorker, Tatler editor, after whom this podcast is named, used to work with Harvey, and she revealed that he would offer a juicy negative nugget about one of the movie stars or his colleagues, usually me, in order to trade or quash a dangerous piece about himself.
When you read the accounts, you see why it has somehow been kept under wraps for all this time. He sounds like a textbook power mad man. He was very charming, then he would be very cruel. He showed zero emotion after each incident of abuse. It was as if this was just part of his everyday life. He was a man completely drunk on power, and he exerted it with such violent panache and confidence that everyone around him thought that it was just a part of the system of Hollywood that could never be called into question officially or destroyed. You even read of how his assistants used to have to do a turndown duty, which literally meant putting this grown man to bed. And it's like he believed himself to be this sort of omnipotent Roman emperor. You know, the man facilitates films. That's all he does. There isn't a job or a position of power or creativity in the world that should ever override the obligation that we all have to each other to respect the basic rights of humans.
A Twitter account I highly recommend following for coverage of it all, and also discussion way beyond Harvey Weinstein as, you know, a singular figure, is the Twitter account of Anne Helen Peterson, the BuzzFeed reporter who wrote Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, a book of pop culture essays about women in the public eye that I waxed lyrical about on the high-low earlier this year. Some of the stuff that I've learned from her Twitter timeline is that the Weinstein Company is expected to rename within 48 hours.
Wow.
I wonder what Christmas is going to be like with Bob and Harvey now. And also that his wife, Georgina, is really mad, but not at Harvey. She's more worried about the impact that it will have on her label, Marquesa, and they're not talking divorce.
Oh, my God. Well, speaking of labels, did you see what Donna Karan said about the whole thing? She was interviewed about, I think it might have been on the red carpet, and she said that his alleged victims might have been asking for it by their choice of clothing. I think we have to look at ourselves. Obviously, the treatment of women all over the world is something that always had to be identified. Certainly in the country of Haiti, where I work in Africa, in the developing world, it's been a hard time for women. I also think, how do we display ourselves? How do we present ourselves as women? What are we asking? Are we asking for it by presenting all the sensuality and all the sexuality? You look at everything all over the world today and how women are dressing and what they are asking by just presenting themselves the way they do. What are they asking for? Trouble. I mean, I just can't believe she said this. Eva Wiseman tweeted it with just the caption, interesting hill to die on. And Mia Farrow tweeted just being like, well, that's the last time I wear DKNY.
She has said her words are taken out of context. I mean, they'd have to be like lifted a really long old way.
Yeah.
But also, what the fuck has Haiti got to do with Harvey Weinstein?
I know.
You know, women are having it tough. In Haiti, they're having it tough. And what dress are you wearing? Like, what the
it's
actual
mad.
Fuck? Doesn't paint the fashion industry, which I work in a lot, in the best light. I swear they don't all say stuff like that. There's been a lot of responses and backlash about why it took so long for this all to come out. And I was really interested and wholly agree with the notion of gossip being protection. Anne Helen Peterson wrote a piece for BuzzFeed who says, much like I also say as a journalist, we knew about him because of a much derided and feminized way that women gain knowledge, celebrity gossip. It's a brilliant piece as ever, and I'll link it on our Twitter and put it in the show notes. And it basically explains that celebrity gossip isn't just titillating or frivolous. For women, it can be a means of survival. To spread knowledge of sex abusers is vital for women. And I think that's something to really bear in mind when we see all these inevitable endless tweets going, well, why didn't you come out sooner? Why did you hide it for so long? Oh my God, all you all wanted to do is earn money, you like disgusting rapists. Like, I've literally seen kind of comments like this under it. And I think it's important to remember that it takes a lot to be a whistleblower. I say this a lot about a lot of different scandals or incidences or takedowns. I think, you know, you have to be very brave to be a whistleblower, but I don't mean moral bravery necessarily. I mean economic bravery. Are you brave enough to potentially ruin your whole career and descend into bankruptcy? If I worked for a publication and at the very top was a man known to be a pervert, I think it's unlikely that I would have blown the whistle on him, knowing I'd be fired and probably inevitably destitute. You have to be in a strong position to lead any kind of change. You have to be a remarkable man or woman. Most men or women are not remarkable. And that doesn't make a woman a coward or implicit in a sex scandal. It makes her scared.
I think that's a very good point about the power of the rumour spreading amongst women. I haven't thought of it like that, particularly when you think about when you're an actor on set. I've been on set, I've seen how this works. You are essentially treated like a baby. And, you know, you think back to Romola Garai's story. She was a baby. She was 18 years old. The exec sent her up to this sexual predator with a sort of weariness, as if he was like a pervy but harmless uncle. And she had to do what they said. I feel like I've only just found my voice and confidence to ask questions and challenge things, or that I don't want to do things in the workplace. And I'm in my late 20s. And that's in the context of working for institutions that are monitored and have HR departments, not on the largely unmonitored set of a movie.
That's a really good comment to make about age as well. These stories may all be coming out now when Gwyneth is in her 40s, Ashley Judd, I think, might be in her late 40s now, Lauren Savannah is in her 30s. All of these happened when these women were at the very start of their careers. They were always in their early 20s. They were young, and it was definitely, it seems like, a very consistent and deliberate
predatory
navigation
tactic.
towards very young women. I also want to ask, why are we expecting all the women to speak out, the victims? Why aren't we asking the men, many of whom knew as well but were never targeted themselves, so arguably had the strength of not being a victim themselves, to comment on it? Why do we have Ben Affleck denying all knowledge, as he did on Instagram, whilst various sources claim he knew and helped cover it up? Why aren't we asking other key directors to step forward? Why are we criticising women like Ashley Judd, who is speaking out now over 20 years later, who was a victim, and not questioning people who were not victimised but knew all the same?
Colin Firth actually has spoken out, and he has described Weinstein as being a very frightening and powerful man. But I think it will be really telling to watch now which men speak out, because that will really show who the true allies are to women in Hollywood that are working now. Their silence will speak volumes.
I also have to say as well that I won't be as like monumentally impressed with the bravery of the men who speak out now, because they're fucking safe. He's gone down.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they weren't breaking privilege and revealing this at an earlier time. They're doing it when a ton of other women have already done it, and then they can come along on their coattails and be like, I really respect women, it's so terrible. I mean, I never knew. Like, I didn't see that hand go up that skirt.
Very true.
I'm really excited to see what happens next. Does this pave the way for other takedowns? Does it pave the way for women to move into positions of seniority in the movie industry? Does it obliterate or at least partly dismantle that casting couch cliche? Will Harvey be seen to publicly reform and be accepted back into the fold? I hope not, but you never know. Will the systemic sexism that Hollywood has been built upon be finally and sensationally and fully dismantled once and for all? Time will tell. We'll be sharing all the links to as much as we possibly can online, even though the 140 characters on Twitter is killing me with the article links. I mean, for God's sake, Twitter, you've got 280 characters. Why can't you road test it on the high-low? We'll also be putting them all into the show notes. Please do let us know what you think. We've been really, really riveted, as most people have this week, by this scandal.
Time for Ask the Hilo. This is a very sad email that we got. The subject title is Annus Horribilis.
Hello Dolly and Pandora. My dad died 10 years ago after a 4-year struggle with cancer. I watched my great father ebb away from this cruelest of diseases and saw my mum nurse him nobly the entire time. As I was going through this nightmare, I expected unwavering support from my partner of 10 years. But whilst he came to the funeral with me and held my hand, I now know it was probably just for show. Rather than coming together during this time, we drifted apart and became separate islands. He went out every night and got back late for about a year, and it became so obvious he didn't want to be near me at all after my dad had passed away. One weekend, we hashed it out. Tears, hugs, sex, hours of opening our hearts to each other. I wanted to give it another go, but he couldn't. We split up and I moved out, desperate to get out of our home for 7 years. 3 weeks on from the split, I know now that he is seeing and sleeping with a girl from work. I believe him when he said nothing physical happened when we were together, but the emotional affair is clear. My life has been ripped apart. I need to start again. Any warm or tough words of wisdom would be so welcome right now. 2017 can do one.
This really spoke to me because my best friend in the whole world...
Yeah, it reminded me of her.
Yeah, she lost her sibling in a very tragic way, and then she lost her fiancé a few months later. And I actually emailed her this email and I said, is there anything that you would say to this girl?
Oh, I'm so glad you did that.
Yeah.
That's a lovely idea.
Yeah, she said I must say now that she's out the other side and she... is obviously she's not grateful that she lost her sister, but she's grateful for what the experiences have taught her, and she feels kind of more herself than ever now, I think. She said the things that got her through were friends, and we really did rally around her. And one of the reasons we did rally around her is she was very good at raising the flag and saying, I'm going to need you here. This is a date that's going to be difficult. This is an anniversary. This is the day he's moving out. This is whatever. And that communication, as embarrassing as it may feel, was so helpful for us as her friends for getting her through it. I would be as communicative as possible with your friends because they want to help. And the minute that you start a dialogue where you're like, can you be here on this time? I'm having a bad week. They'll want to be there for you as much as possible. So that would be my first bit of advice. She also said she changed her job, which really helped. She wanted to be somewhere where not everyone knew her story.
Mm.
She wanted to be more than her tragedy. And you don't need to do that right now. If you're happy in your job, obviously don't leave it. But maybe think of ways that you can slightly change your scenery, maybe not a job, in other ways, that means that you can rebuild an identity that's not just about the huge loss that you faced. She said exercise got her through it. She took up running. I think it really helped her to stay present and in her body and not go kind of mad in her thoughts. And we took the piss out of her for this in a loving way. She started like new courses that she did in the evenings.
She told me about this the other day. She listed them all. They were, I mean, masses.
Yeah, ceramics. What else did she do? Karate. And, you know, there's a reason why this is like the joke of when you get divorced, that this is what people do. But it really helped her. It helped her build her self-esteem. Again, it distracted her. She met new people and she really enjoyed it. And it was a lovely way for her to kind of fill her time, not be in her head. So that's my advice from my friend. And all I can say is, you know, the thing that I used to keep saying to her is, I don't want this to colour your outlook of the world. I don't want you to think that this is going to be the tone of the rest of your life, or that tragedy is something that is going to keep occurring. There's just no rhyme or reason of why things happen to people at whatever time. And yes, there has been great darkness in your life and great sadness, but you just have to believe me, my darling, when I tell you that great, great light and happiness is on its way to you as well.
I have a friend who lost a family member to cancer and then broke up with her other half very shortly afterwards. And like you say, actually, one of the things I kept saying to her is, this loss is not going to define you.
Yeah.
You know, you will always miss your dad, but you will not always miss him. You will be glad that that relationship broke down one day. Mm. Do you wish it hadn't happened all at once? Yes, but grief does accelerate breakups. There's a statistic, I think it's something like 70% of marriages break down when parents lose a child.
Yeah.
And I know that actually because my parents lost a child before I was born, and it's, you know, strength to their partnership that they are still together. But I also think the other thing that I'd like to say is that my friend dealt with the grief of the breakup of her relationship more immediately, or was confronted with the grief of it more immediately than the grief she had for her father. And she really beat herself up with that. She felt, she was like, why am I caring about this piece of shit when I should be caring about my father? And it actually meant that she had a delayed response to the grief of her father. And when it hit her, it hit her so much harder because she hadn't experienced it the first time around. So all of these things are really normal. For example, I am someone that freaks out over the tiny stuff. I'm known for getting in like a complete state about really small things. But when really big things have happened, I am oddly calm. I have never once, for example, lost it over my sister being very ill, but I would very likely have lost it a million times over something completely pedantic. So don't try and measure the grief you're feeling. You know,
yes,
don't
that's
think,
good advice.
Don't panic that you're grieving in one way for one thing and not as much as you should for the other thing. I think that moving back home might feel like a backward step for you in a way, but I actually think there's something loving about being back in your family's embrace and going through that together. I think that's something your friend went through
as well.
Yeah,
that's what she did. She moved back in her, and she was there for a year and she's just moved out and she thinks of that time as being a real haven. Yeah.
The problem is you, I think you said your wonderful father only died 10 weeks ago. You've got a bloody year ahead of you. I hope it's less than a year, but I'm going to go in with a year. You might have a bit longer. You might hopefully have less time where obviously you'll still be devastated, but you'll feel the ability to enjoy life rather than just utterly despairing at it. Don't focus on anything past getting out of bed, eating a meal and putting one foot in front of the other.
Exactly.
Just get through those days, and then at some point, those days won't just be something to tolerate. They might be something to occasionally enjoy. And then they might be something to slightly more than occasionally enjoy. And then they might be something to mostly enjoy. And that time will come. But in the short term, the best advice is what Dolly's friend gave, that she herself had gone through. Maybe try some courses, read some great books, go on a run, sleep, eat, just do the basics. Just put one foot in front of the other and the rest will hopefully follow.
And reach out to your friends because they want to be there for you.
Takes an army.
Yeah, takes an army, and you're going to need them.
Thank you so much to everyone who listened to the Hilo. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. It helps boost us on iTunes. The next two episodes will be live podcasts, which means you will be listening to us in front of a live audience. Dolly and I will probably sound as sweaty as we will look.
I will be so sweaty.
So don't despair. This isn't happening every week. We don't have enough good hair days for that. But the next two episodes will be live. You'll be listening to them post. And we're so excited to meet everyone that's coming. And to those of you that don't come, we have no interest in you and I wouldn't bother listening.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.